Here at thesyncbook.com, we are a community exploring the impossible. Artists and seekers looking at the interconnected nature of all things. As of 2015, Syncbook Radio has over 25 gigs of high-quality audio without a single advertisement. And we keep on growing. We now have 6 radio programs producing regular content. Clearly, we have outgrown one model and are birthing another. We have spent the last 5 years attempting to build a space where researchers and seekers can take an honest approach to this material, where people can look at these weird things without being laughed at or yelled at, to build a community that encourages each other to continue to learn and to explore. This quest began in earnest with the publication of the first Syncbook back in 2011. Since then, it has ballooned into a major undertaking, and thesyncbook.com has become a repository for cutting-edge media and all things sync. Along the way, we have found amazing allies to become an unparalleled creative team. We have met the most supportive and loving fans. And, of course, we've bumped heads with a few assholes. With all of your help, we've been able to grow and provide a platform to more artists. Now, we are asking you to take the next step with us. After investing a ton of time, energy, money, and hard fucking work, thesyncbook.com has just finished its major overhaul, and we are ready for you to make yourselves cozy here. We've installed new players for our podcasts, with streaming from fast and reliable hosting. We added expanded search functions that tap into classic sync video libraries. And our new member section gives access to our full archive of over 600 hours of podcasts, as well as members-only media, HD videos, and transcripts. There's also discounted physical copies of Syncbook Press titles, as well as Google Hangouts with the radio hosts every month. You'll also have an opportunity to tap into additional exclusive media inside Dropbox 42. For those of you unable to purchase memberships, rest assured that the 3 most recent episodes of all podcasts will remain free for everyone, every week. So regular listeners will be able to continue enjoying these shows uninterrupted. While financial realities dictate that we can't keep up this level of output and continue to give away everything for free, we've made every possible effort to make this something all of you would really want to be a part of. Please visit thesyncbook.com/membership now.
This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on Syncbook Radio. Today, on episode number 6, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, philosopher and computer scientist Bernardo Kastrup, as well as a second one-on-one dialogue with science journalist and futurist Mats Levon. This episode brings together 2 contrasting paradigms concerning 1, the nature of mind, and 2, how people exist in relation to their environment. My guests' point of view fundamentally differ in their definition of what reality is, how the universe functions, and what it means to be a conscious human within it. Are human beings on a certain level actually manifestations of consciousness that embody a grand archetypal purpose? Or are we merely a collection of deterministic biological robots, nothing more than evolutionary stepping stones for a superior machine intelligence of our own making? I see that as the core question, and I'll leave it up to you to decide for yourself. Thanks again to my guests, and thanks again to you for listening. Thank you. joining us today on Pentimental is philosopher of science Bernardo Kastrup. Bernardo is a PhD in computer engineering. He's worked as a scientist in some of the world's foremost research laboratories, including CERN, also known as the European Organization for Nuclear Research, and Philips Research Laboratories. He's also the author of 4 books, his most recent being Why Materialism is Baloney. So, Bernardo, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, again, I did just kind of give a brief intro, but maybe you'd like to elucidate on that a little more and tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, I started out as a scientist. My education, my formal education is in science and engineering. I have an engineering degree, well, a few engineering degrees. But I worked as an engineer in science organizations in the early days of my career. Now I am in technology corporate world, in my nightlife, so to say. I do philosophy, which is a passion of mine for the last nearly 10 years or so.
Now, in your most recent book, the focus is mostly on consciousness. So perhaps we'll start there. And there are two sort of main philosophies of science that contend with one another. We have materialism, which is sort of the status quo position. And then we have sort of this other one, which is more ubiquitous to say in like an Eastern tradition or something like that called idealism. So maybe you'd like to define each of these for us briefly and how they measure up against each other, or, you know, what are the differences and why is there even a disagreement here?
Yeah. Well, materialism is a conflation of two things. It conflates the metaphysics of realism, the idea that the world exists fundamentally outside consciousness. It would still go on even if there were no conscious observers looking at it. That's realism. Materialism takes that in and adds one other element. It adds the element that consciousness itself is generated by particular specific arrangements of matter. So your brain squirts out consciousness, similarly to how your stomach squirts out digestive juices, for instance. That would be the analogy. So that's materialism, and it's pretty mainstream, so mainstream that most people take it for granted without a second thought. And I have been guilty of that for actually most of my life. The alternative, it's so obvious, so right under our noses that it's difficult to see. The alternative is there is only consciousness, because subjective experience is the only carrier of reality any one of us can ever know for sure. Our entire lives unfold in the theater of subjective experience. We postulate, we infer a world outside experience in order to make sense of a few things that we think we can't make sense of in any other way, like the fact that we share the same reality, the fact that there are very tight correlations between brain activity and experience, and so on and so forth. But fundamentally, materialism is based on inferences, on explanations. Life itself, as far as anyone can ever know, unfolds in the theater of consciousness. And idealism as a philosophy, as a metaphysics, states that consciousness alone is sufficient to explain all phenomenology, to explain all reality, to explain the entire universe.
Why is this question even important? So we're bringing this up, but why do you see this question as important in how we define our consciousness and how we define who we are?
It's critical at all levels. Let's start from a very personal level, from a question that is very important to most people. When you die, is it the end of your consciousness? Is it the end of the experience of the experience of being I, being you, being me, and so on? If you believe in materialism, the implication of that is, since consciousness is squirted out by particular arrangements of matter, once those arrangements of matter disintegrate or dissolve or in any other way change, which is what happens when you physically die, then that's the end of your consciousness. Your experience, the stream of your experiences will cease, and what you consider to be yourself will be annihilated. Under idealism, however, all reality is in consciousness. Consciousness is not generated. It's not squirted out by a particular arrangement of matter. Matter is in consciousness as a particular modality, a particular type of experience. It is your body, thus, your physical body, that is in consciousness, not consciousness in your physical body. Therefore, under idealism, there is just no reason to believe that a physical death will entail the end of your consciousness. because it is the body that dies that is in your consciousness. Death happens within you. So your consciousness, your stream of experience, doesn't end, although it certainly will change.
In your book, Why Materialism is Baloney, you start to dig into the question of neuroscience, materialistic neuroscience, and maybe why that isn't all that it's cracked up to be and how it can be sort of misleading. Because if we just try to make this one-to-one correlation between brain activity, electrochemical activity in the brain, and states of consciousness, it really doesn't add up. So maybe you can, again, explain that a little better for us.
Well, materialism it doesn't come out of nowhere, right? If you look at it, there are some good reasons to believe in materialism at first sight, until you think about it more carefully. One of them is, of course, as you alluded to, from neuroscience. We have found in neuroscience today very tight, very specific, even beautiful correlations between certain experiences and states of the brain, even between specific groups of neurons and certain types of experience. For instance, with transcranial magnetic stimulation, neuroscientists can shut down specific parts of your brain and manipulate your experience and your behavior in that way. We all know from personal experience that if we consume certain psychoactive drugs like alcohol, for instance, our experience of the world will change rather dramatically, the use of anesthesia and so on and so forth. So these correlations encourage people to think that the brain generates consciousness. Yet, it's an old argument, but I will repeat it. Correlation doesn't imply causation. Things that happen together don't necessarily cause each other. I happen to believe that the brain is the image of a process of localization in a broader transpersonal stream of consciousness, analogously to how a whirlpool is the image of a process of localization in a stream of water. The brain doesn't cause consciousness for the same reason that a whirlpool doesn't cause water. The whirlpool is just the image of a process in the flow of water, the brain being just the image of a process in the flow of experience, a localization in the flow of experience that leads to the illusion of personal identity. Of course, there are many counter-arguments to this. I don't know how deep you want to go into this, but that's the gist, that's the essence of the argument I put forward in the book.
Well, what do you think are some of the best pieces of evidence that contradict that idea of correlation in the materialist paradigm? Because we can argue this out on a philosophical and intellectual level, but at the same time, we have to return to empiricism and science to maybe help bolster our arguments or whatever. So what do you think is some of the best evidence that supports this idea of idealism?
Idealism makes less postulates. Materialism requires you to infer a whole universe outside the only carrier of reality that you can ever know, which is experience. It's like postulating the flying spaghetti monster. It's a postulate that makes sense if it is the only way and the most parsimonious way to explain observations. Idealism postulates less. It denies the flying spaghetti monster. It says we don't need that whole universe outside of experience. Reality is an excitation of consciousness itself. From that perspective, it is not idealism that needs empirical evidence to be proven. It is materialism. It is the extra entity, the extra postulate, the less parsimonious alternative that needs empirical justification. That said, recently, over the last 10 years or so, experiments in quantum non-locality have been providing strong evidence in favor of idealism. It seems to be untenable to say that reality exists fundamentally outside our experience of it. Experiments that show what in physics has come to be called certain inequalities, that if they are violated as predicted by quantum physics, it becomes very difficult to imagine that the world is unfolding out there independently of our conscious experience. And in my latest book, I make a summary of the key papers. A very important one has been published in Nature magazine in 2007. Published by a group out of Austria, in which their conclusion was that, based on their experiments, either we have to abandon realism, this idea that the universe is outside of consciousness, or we have to modify our conception of realism so profoundly that what would be left could hardly be called realism.
And what's interesting to me about quantum physics is that so often the Copenhagen interpretation, which is the shut up and make your measurements interpretation, and is so often put out as the only answer. But then there are a few others. You have the multiverse, you have maybe David Bohm's ontological interpretation. And then again, this idea of consciousness is actually inseparable from everything and perhaps creating the situation itself. And just on that level, you know, science, I think, misrepresents itself, that there isn't a consensus agreement, that there isn't a hard and fast rule for how to interpret this stuff. So, yeah, these questions of what is quantum physics, it's not ironed out at all. So when someone like Sean Carroll comes on and says, we've got it figured out, let's not even look into something like near-death experience, I think that is doing a injustice to the intellectual development of people that maybe are undecided.
Absolutely. The levels of foolishness and prejudice amongst the self-appointed guardians of reason today, which happen to be the most vocal people in the media, is simply astonishing. The situation would be hilarious if it weren't tragic.
Now, also, what do you make of, say, again, like near-death experience research, parapsychology? Do you fit these into your paradigm at all? And do you think that's good research?
It's difficult to generalize it, but I'm sure there is very good research and probably there is very bad research as well. I try to stay on the philosophy side of things. I try not to commit the same mistake that scientists do when they try to do philosophy without even knowing that they're trying to do philosophy. Stephen Hawking and some other of these famous guys are notorious for doing that. I can't judge research that I haven't been intimately involved with. That said, there are some people out there doing research and coming out with conclusions, people who seem to be reliable, serious, honest in what they do. And I think the evidence should be taken seriously and looked at with attention instead of simply being discarded because it happens not to fit a certain paradigm of thought. And if you look to history, a very brief look to history will be sufficient to tell us that most paradigms of thought are very short-lived and not permanent at all.
Right. And I mean, for me, again, like you said, sometimes this does have to be more philosophical and you don't want to make the same mistakes as materialism. But when I see certain research, say, coming out of University of Virginia, Dr. Bruce Grayson, Dr. Jeff Long, Penny Sartori, all these other near-death experience researchers, what this seems to indicate is that there is, besides quantum physics indicating a non-local nature to consciousness, here we have people whose brains aren't operative in the standard materialistic sense, yet here they are outside their bodies, hearing things without ears, seeing things without eyes, going to other physical locations and bringing back actually verifiable information. And now this isn't always the case. And so in that case, we can actually distinguish between hallucinations and what seem to be actual experience. And that is a bit of a conundrum for materialism, I think.
Yeah, we have to be careful. I mean, I like all this. The way this would fit under my it's not my metaphysics. It's very old. I give it a modern articulation, so to say, perhaps a more complete articulation. But you see, if the brain-body system is merely the image of a localization in a transpersonal stream of experience, once the body-brain system stops working and dissolves, what would you expect? You would expect a delocalization of the flow of experience, a declenching of consciousness. In the same way that when a whirlpool dissolves, the water doesn't disappear, it just delocalizes, it declenches, it runs over the entire length of the stream instead of circulating around a certain locus in space-time. So the evidence from near-death experience seems to be consistent with this idea. When brain activity goes down, reduces, or even stops completely, people seem to report a declenching, an expansion of the breadth of consciousness, which is what one would expect under an idealist interpretation of reality. Now, that said, we have to be careful, you see, because there are many layers of explanation that are necessary to make sense of this. If you close your eyes right now, you will not be able to see. So apparently your consciousness needs this thing that we call open eyes to see the world around. So if you're clinically dead and your eyes are closed, and even if they were open, they wouldn't be working anyway, how can you see everything around you? You see, these things have to be made sense of. And I don't think it's enough to just look at the evidence and say, okay, that's it, it's idealism. No, idealism needs to be articulated properly to make sense of all sides of the evidence, including the ordinary ones. Like, if you close your eyes, you don't see. So how come you see when you're dead? This has to be made sense of. And that's the gist of my work. That's what I try to do.
Now, we're talking about that you're talking about us being, the metaphor you use is whirlpools in the stream of consciousness. And as you go along in the book, you start out with a very simple metaphor of, say, like quicksilver, a quicksilver mirror, and then you develop that further and further. So I like how you keep building on the metaphor to maybe a more sophisticated model that integrates both, again, this kind of common sense sensibility of self-reflective entity, and then you build upon that drawing from investigations into space-time over the years. And so I guess, how have you come to model what consciousness is? I mean, we can't say exactly what it is as a substance, but it's not energy, it's not matter. Then what the hell is it?
Matter, substance, all objects are concepts that arise in consciousness. What else can they be? These are things we conceptualized, we created within the matrix of our consciousness. We thought matter. We thought energy. Some of these concepts, for instance, energy, are even very difficult to pin down merely conceptually. It's very difficult to say what energy is, but whatever it is a concept that arose within consciousness. Consciousness is what there is. It's what is. It's the primary datum of reality. It is the one irreducible aspect of existence because it's the first. It's the one that was never born and will never die. It's the fundament of everything. To say that we need to explain consciousness is akin to saying that you need to bite your own teeth, like Alan Watts used to say, or taste your own tongue, or look at your own eye without a mirror, or touch the tip of a finger with the tip of the same finger. We can't do that because consciousness is that which thinks, which observes, which speculates, which creates models, which generates explanations. So my definition of consciousness, the one I use in my work, is very operational to avoid this problem, to avoid this self-reference. I simply say consciousness is that whose excitations are experience. And therefore, consciousness is that whose excitations are the whole of reality, because the whole of reality is experience, as far as anyone can ever know. And then what we have to model are the patterns and regularities of those unfolding experiences. There are identifiable patterns and regularities. We've come to call them the laws of nature and the laws of psychology. We split them into two different domains. I would argue that they are all part of the same domain. The archetypes of Carl Jung, the archetypes of the psyche, are just the same type of thing as the fundamental laws of physics or other laws of nature. They are the patterns and regularities of the excitations of the medium of consciousness itself, consciousness being what there is. This is no more complicated or difficult than, for instance, the current state of the art in materialism. Quantum field theory would tell you that the one irreducible thing in the universe is the quantum vacuum, and all reality arises as excitations of the quantum vacuum. What is the quantum vacuum? We can't say. It is the irreducible thing. We can never explain one thing in terms of another, in terms of another, in terms of another, forever. At some point, you hit rock bottom and you say, this entity is what there is. For field quantum theorists, it's the quantum vacuum. For me, it's the obvious one, the one that is right on your face since you were born. It's consciousness itself.
Right. I mean, ultimately, we have to make that decision. Everyone is confronted with it. So in a book like A Universe from Nothing by hardcore atheist materialist Lawrence Krauss, it'd be like, well, it's nothing. He attaches these words to it. And again, that's coming from his consciousness, and he takes that as self-evident. It's like we're all kind of taking that leap of faith. And the question is, what, like you said, what is the most economical, what makes the least leap of faith?
Yeah. You see, materialism is plagued by not one, but two very serious problems. One is parsimony. It needs to postulate an entire bloody universe, fundamentally outside the only carrier of reality we can know, which is consciousness. That universe is an inference. It can never really be proven. That's one problem. The other problem is that after they do that, they can't explain consciousness itself, which, for all we know, is all there is. So they postulate a universe outside consciousness. Now it's fashion to postulate infinite universes, outside, parallel universes outside consciousness, and that they can't explain consciousness, which is how it all starts. All those universes that were postulated, they arose as concepts in consciousness. And of course, they can't explain that which conceptualized them. We are just chasing our own tails at light speed, and it gets surreal sometimes. Like, there is a stream in materialism called eliminative materialism. Those jokers deny the very existence of consciousness. They say that we are unconscious computers that compute that we are conscious. It's like a little computer program that has a variable called conscious. And then at some point in all its complicated calculations, it attributes the Boolean value true to the variable conscious. And that is supposed to explain consciousness or prove that it doesn't exist. That is preposterous. I mean, the intellectual gymnastics and acrobatics that is required to get into such contrivance is, in my view, it borders on academically sanctioned insanity.
And you mentioned this a little bit before, but you have people like, yeah, Stephen Hawking or Neil deGrasse Tyson saying philosophy is dead. All we need is science, but they are taking for granted all their own philosophical biases. They don't even understand that they're practicing philosophy because they don't know the first thing about it. So
it is an amazing expression of philosophical stupidity. I mean, they are doing philosophy. Stephen Hawking made a statement that the universe could and would create itself from nothing because of laws such as gravity. Well, the law of gravity is not nothing. This is a philosophically incoherent statement on the face of it. This would fail a first-year student of philosophy at the university. And here we have this guy making a statement like this, and the media picks it up and promotes it because this guy is supposed to be the most intelligent person on the planet. I mean, this is a very serious symptom of our cultural insanity. It's not only his fault, it's the fault of the whole culture that elevates him to the level of judge and arbiter of all ontological truth, something that he, as a puzzle solver, he doesn't have the first clue about.
And I also find it a bit ironic that they don't even see their own position in society as mirroring, say, the medieval church in the Middle Ages. I mean, they're on high with their dogma and telling everyone what reality is. And there's no introspection, there's no self-reflection, there's no awareness of history throughout all of this. And even if there is an awareness, it is repressed or not talked about because, well, it's not politically convenient, not economically convenient, it's not convenient for their careers. So we have all these other cultural and historical blind spots interfering with what I'd consider the pursuit of truth.
Yeah. These guys, they think that a wealth of empirical data replaces proper thinking. I'll give you an example. I was engaged in an online exchange with materialist Jerry Coyne, professor of biology who wrote a book about evolution, Darwinian evolution. At some point he wrote that my idealism was, of course, untenable, because there is plenty of evidence for the existence of the universe before conscious life arose. Now, this is, on the face of it, a circular argument. You see, he's assuming that consciousness arises out of biology and therefore is circumscribed by biology. So before biology arose, there was no consciousness. Therefore, evidence for the universe existing before biology denies idealism, refutes idealism. That's completely circular. He's arguing against idealism by assuming materialism in his argument. It's begging the question, as we call it in philosophy. You see, under idealism, life is a localization of consciousness. It's a dissociation of consciousness. Living beings are dissociated alters, alter egos of the one mind behind all reality, so to say, like a person with dissociative identity disorder. But consciousness does not depend on biology in order to exist. Biology is just the image of certain processes in consciousness. So there might, of course, have been, and there was, a universe before life arose, and that universe was still in consciousness, undivided, undissociated consciousness. And he doesn't seem to see that. He writes something like this with a lot of arrogance and hubris, in all honesty, taking the logical high ground like an emperor with no clothes, making a basic logical mistake, not even philosophical. This is basic logic, a basic logical mistake. Really, like an emperor with no clothes. I, I, I have quite a laugh every now and then in these debates I take part in.
And more recently, you actually appeared at the Sages and Scientists Conference that made the effort to bring together, again, like both sides of the argument, materialists and, well, not everyone's a quote-unquote idealist, but the other side, which is, again, consciousness is primary. Now, how was that experience for you, and what did you glean from it, or how did you interpret that whole experience?
Well, the whole experience was very nice. Sages and Scientists, organized by the Chopra Foundation, is a fantastic event. I wish it would get more attention, that people would watch more the videos, even if they wouldn't be there personally. It has limited attendance locally, but the videos are made available. The specific event, the specific part of that big event that you're probably referring to is the debate on Friday evening between the so-called proponents and the skeptics. I don't like to grant the name skeptics to materialists because I think they are not skeptic at all.
Right.
They should be a lot more skeptic.
Right.
But anyway, there were people like Leonard Mlodinow, who wrote that book with Stephen Hawking. He's a famous physicist. Michael Shermer, publisher of Skeptic magazine and sort of field marshal of militant skepticism worldwide. They were there. There was a well-known physicist from the Max Planck Institute. There was me, there was Henry Stapp, and then the other crowd, the proponent crowd. That debate was very nice. No argument against my position was raised by Leonard or Michael that I hadn't faced or seen before. I am not disappointed, to be honest with you. I didn't expect to see anything new. Materialists don't engage frequently enough, not nearly enough, in an intelligent discussion about an intelligent alternative to their metaphysics to exercise their ability to come up with arguments. So I'm not surprised that they didn't come up with anything that I hadn't seen before. The debate was friendly, cordial, but in a certain way, a bit mediocre, because even the arguments they came up with were not the best they could have come up with. They left on the table the best ammunition they could have used. And I would have had more fun if they had used it, because it would become a more appealing exchange if we had really drilled down into the core issues. But that said, it was a very nice debate. I had a lot of fun, and I would encourage everybody to look at it. It's available for free on my YouTube channel, for instance.
Yeah, right. And again, it's like one of those rare opportunities to see those two sides come together. And Alex Karras on Skeptico does this too, only through a podcasting format. But again, it just doesn't happen that often, because most of the, I guess, science media is dominated by the materialist paradigm, and that is largely an echo chamber. They're not bringing on people like you. They're not interested in hearing these other interpretations. They think they have it all figured out. And
that's true. Partly it's their fault. Partly it's our own as well. It is true that the mainstream media is very biased when it comes to giving coverage to intelligent alternatives to materialism. That said, you know, in all honesty, there is some horrendous stuff being shouted at the fringes of the culture, which gets conflated with anything that is against materialism. So instead of looking at, of separating things and saying, okay, there is materialism, there is idealism, and there are a number of other things that are also internally coherent and empirically consistent. And then there is some crazy stuff, and there is some hysterical stuff that's being promoted, maybe for commercial reasons or by people who can't really think straight or are not honest when it comes to looking at the empirical evidence and so forth. But all that gets conflated into materialism versus the rest. And then when you are in that basket with all the rest, you get contaminated. Mm. So if people from the mainstream media would look at my work and they would immediately associate me with, oh, materialist denier, therefore not intelligent, not logical, not empirically honest, not coherent, and probably religious, woo-woo, voodoo, whatever, you know, and that gets very difficult.
And so much of this comes down to denying our own experience. And Michael Shermer, who shared the stage with you at that conference, he seems to be one of the people that does this. And more recently, he actually wrote an article saying he had this astounding sort of totally paradigm-busting paranormal experience that, quote-unquote, shook his atheism to the core, thereby revealing his hand that, again, it's a dogma and he's not really, it's a fixed position for him. It's not something that is flexible in his mind. It's the truth, and it has to shake his faith because it is a faith. Again, you see that even when confronted with the most extreme experience saying, hey, rethink what you're thinking, they can just kind of dismiss it.
just to do justice to Michael, he said that the anomaly shook his skepticism to the core, not his atheism. You know, I will not comment on the old Michael Shermer, but I will comment kindly on the new Michael Shermer, because what I have seen coming out of him in recent months has been encouraging. And even until a few years ago, if you go back a few years into the past, Michael has made comments like the materialist science around consciousness is unfalsifiable. That's quite an admission to say that the materialist science of consciousness is unfalsifiable. It's entirely true. But that he was ready to admit that, and his writings of last year in the summer when he related the anomaly that he and his wife experienced, which was basically a fantastic synchronicity. And I don't know whether your audience is familiar with the Jungian term synchronicity, the idea of a meaningful coincidence between an objective event in the world and an inner state of mind. He had an experience like that, which he says shook his skepticism to the core. I wrote an article in reply to his, and in my article I suggest that the anomaly should not have shaken his skepticism. What he needs is more skepticism in order to make sense of the anomaly, not less. We mistake the notion of skepticism. Skepticism is about not postulating more theoretical entities than you need in order to make sense of things. This is what skepticism is. We are not going to postulate the flying spaghetti monster because with natural selection, we can make sense of the evidence. We don't need the extra theoretical entity of the flying spaghetti monster. That is skepticism. But we mistake that with pruning the degrees of freedom of nature. We start thinking that to be skeptic is to not allow nature to have certain degrees of freedom, like telekinesis, telepathy, synchronicities, or whatever. That's not skepticism. Who are we to tell nature what can or cannot happen? We are not here to tell nature that. We are here to look at nature, to observe what happens and make sense of it with as few postulated theoretical entities as possible. There are historical precedents for this. At some point 500 years ago, we would explain electrostatic attraction, like pieces of amber attracting chaff because of electrostatic attraction. We would explain that with the invisible material entity that scientists at the time called the effluvium, a sort of elastic band that would pull the chaff to the amber, an invisible elastic band. And of course, that unnecessarily postulated theoretical entity created anomalies, namely electrostatic repulsion. Repulsion became an anomaly, because if it's an elastic band, how can it push chaff away? So it was so serious that the scientists wouldn't even see repulsion. They would describe it in their notebooks as chaff falling off or bouncing off the amber. They weren't able, because they couldn't conceptualize the phenomenon, they wouldn't even observe it. They weren't able to even see it. This is written in a famous book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, by Thomas Kuhn. He relates this. So I think the same is happening now. What was effluvium then, an unnecessary postulated entity, now is the whole universe outside mind. If we get rid of that unnecessarily postulated entity, many anomalies will make sense. Just like electrostatic repulsion started making sense once we got rid of effluvium. So skepticism is about these postulated theoretical entities, not the degrees of freedom of nature. I think Michael should be more skeptic, not less, and then his anomaly would be perfectly natural.
And of course, it's interesting to bring up synchronicity, because I forgot to mention this to you, but I'm on SyncBook Radio. We're a synchronicity-based platform, and then everything else we sort of not spin off of that idea, but synchronicity was always the core motivation for starting this platform and the mystery of it and the fascination with it. And again, like, my interest is more about the scientific dynamic of it and where does it come from and what does it mean. And one of my favorite quotes is from this fellow, Vince Gaddis. He investigated anomalies for a living, and he said, one of the two things I want to know before I die is, what is the meaning of synchronicity? That was the number one thing for him, was what is these strange, meaningful coincidences and why do they intersect with what Jung calls the archetypes? And again, I love how you brought up that these archetypes seems to be patterns in consciousness, the field of consciousness, or however we want to conceptualize that in our mind. because a couple weeks ago I talked to this fellow Don DeGracia, and he draws on the yogic tradition where he says something very similar, where the yogis see consciousness again kind of as a fluid medium or something to that effect, and that our consciousness are patterns within that medium, and that the archetypes themselves, again, are patterns in consciousness, and the interplay between them very much shapes how we interact with the world, how we see ourselves, and all those sorts of things. So I guess maybe you brought up synchronicity. So, you know, synchronicity in your mind, how do you feel about it? What do you think it is, if anything, and has it played any part in your life?
Oh, absolutely. It still does, frequently. Just to do justice to Jung, his idea of the archetype, and this is something that is often misunderstood, the archetype is not a specific embodiment of the pattern. It's not a specific image. It is a tendency to the formation of certain patterns. It is the tendency. It is the template for the pattern, so to say. The pattern itself is already a manifestation of the archetype. The archetype itself is pure. It's empty, in a way. It's just a template. It's a tendency towards certain patterns and regularities. Mm-hmm. I think, and then I'll segue into the question you asked slowly. Give me maybe a minute to get there.
Oh, totally fine.
I think, because I am an idealist, because I think all reality unfolds in a transpersonal mind, of which we are just dissociated alters or localized streams of experience, I think the archetypes are more primary even than the laws of physics and even than the laws of logic. The archetypes are the primordial tendencies of mind, which set the templates according to which mind manifests. Mind manifests according to images and perceptions, which we call the external world, which are basically the outside images of certain psychic processes. And mind manifests in terms of things that we call the part of our inner life, like emotions, thoughts. All of these then will arise from archetypes. The regularities we find in nature, the laws of physics, are the consequence of archetypes. Even math is a manifestation, an embodiment of certain archetypes, archetypes being those primary tendencies towards the manifestation of mind. Mm-hmm. Now, because we are dissociated alters in this broad transpersonal stream of mind that Aldous Huxley called mind at large, from our point of view, as a dissociated alter, there is an outside world. But that outside world is not outside mind. It's outside the alter. It's outside that particular identity which we seem to assume, like a person with dissociative identity disorder. For one personality in a person with DID, the other personality is the outside world, although they're both in the same mind, in the same psyche. So it is this dissociation that creates our illusion of a world outside mind. It is an external world in the sense that it's outside the alter, but it's not outside mind. And synchronicities, in my view, show that this separation is not fundamental. It is superficial. Our internal psychic processes are driven by the same archetypes, by the same tendencies, the same inclinations, the same templates that drive the unfolding of psychic processes outside our alters. In other words, the external world. And because they have a common source, a common origin, it's not surprising at all that they should correspond to each other now and then. They arise from the same fountainhead. Of course, those patterns and regularities will have correspondences. Not all the time, but those correspondences exist. It's not surprising at all, in my view. It's perfectly natural.
I guess one of the, maybe the only argument against synchronicity from a materialist paradigm would be, well, statistically, anything that can happen does. How would you answer that question?
It is, I will appeal to Popper, it is unfalsifiable. You can always make that statement, you see. And that's one of the curious things in how many scientists defend materialism today. We have this concept of randomness, of random data, random phenomena, which is basically a key word for things we don't understand, things we can't really pin down. And then we say, well, random data is data with no specific pattern. At the same time, any pattern can theoretically be found in random data. And you see, this is where things get complicated, because once you have this contradiction, random data is data with no patterns, but any pattern can be found in random data, you can use this idea of anything can happen by chance, you can use it in a highly prejudiced way. When we found the last quark, the top quark, which was discovered in the early 90s, it was announced as a discovery when the odds against chance of the observations being due to the top quark were less than 1,000,000 to 1. In other words, it was almost certain that it was the top quark. 1,000,000 to 1 was sufficient to declare that it was not just by chance, it was not just random, some random background phenomenon, it was the top quark, an official scientific discovery. But if you look at the Global Consciousness Project at Princeton, which now shows that there is an interaction between what we call our personal psyches and objective phenomena unfolding in the world at a global level, it has shown that there is this correlation with odds against chance of about 1,000,000,000,000 to 1. And then you still have scientists saying, yeah, the odds are very small, but you see they are using random number generators and any pattern can theoretically be found in random data. The paradigm becomes unfalsifiable because of this built-in contradiction behind the idea of randomness and chance. You can use it whatever way you like. You can use science to prove or disprove anything you want if you're not more judicious, or at least if you're not more consistent with your criteria regarding what is allowed to be considered, you know, low enough odds against chance that it's true and otherwise not.
Yeah, I see it pretty much the same way. And yeah, so much that we consider to be quote-unquote scientific truth is always based on statistics. So why aren't they lobbying that criticism against their own findings? They're just...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you see, this argument that you mentioned, there are other versions of this argument, and they are used across the board, and they are used to remove meaning out of the picture. Alan Watts, he had a very nice analysis of why science has evolved the way it did over the last 150 years or so, since the 19th century, why it became so much biased against the idea that there is any meaning in nature. I mean, synchronicity is something driven by meaning. When there is a meaningful coincidence of an entire internal psychic state and an objective event in the world, it admits meaning into the picture. But science, at least science as you know it, materialist science, is hell-bent in denying meaning. And the way they do that is by appealing to inconceivably large amounts of alternatives. So, for instance, although the universal constants are incredibly fine-tuned to what they should be for the possibility of there being life in the universe. In other words, if anything were a hair width different than it is, there would be no possibility of life in the universe. But it isn't. It's all fine-tuned for the emergence of life. How do they explain that? Well, there are countless unprovable, undetectable parallel universes in which those constants have other values, in which there is no life, and we happen to live in the one where the constants are, by chance, fine-tuned to enable the origin of life. You see, it's an appeal to countless unprovables, which has the purpose of eliminating meaning out of the picture. So we do that to explain the fine-tuning of the universal constants to life, and we do that to explain away synchronicities. You see, if you experience the synchronicity, how many countless other events were there that were not synchronous at all and you don't remember? It's an appeal to hypothetical infinities, to enormous hypothetical quantities in order to eradicate meaning from life. Yet, we all experience meaning every day. Those enormous hypothetical quantities and parallel universes and whatnot are abstractions. They are not really part of the immediate experience of life. They are thoughts. And we try to drive out an experience that we have constantly in our lives, the experience of meaning, the experience of purpose. We try to drive that out. And Alan Watts' theory was that, you know, in the 19th century, European white men were conquering the world. And it was important to incorporate an idea of realpolitik, you know, the idea that, you know, tough guys win, that they face the bleak facts and they win. It was important to incorporate this idea in our view of nature. And it got incorporated into science as a value system prejudiced against meaning in order to make the world as bleak as possible so scientists could come across as very tough people who face the bleak facts. It's a male adolescent value system, quite frankly, and it's still out there today. You know, just watch the Discovery Channel.
You put it perfectly there. It's adolescents wearing masks. They're pretending that there's something that they're not. I see that in so many ways. But you mentioned right off the bat that, you know, you were for many years devoted to the materialistic side of things. You saw it in that perspective. And I guess my question is to you, what really started making you question things? Because I know personally for me, for so many years, I was an unthinking person. I can't say that I was a materialist per se, but I was part of materialist culture and I didn't question anything, so I had to be. But through a bit of crisis in my life, I began to maybe look deeper at some of these questions. And I guess, is that what happened to you, or how did you come around to changing your mind?
I wouldn't say I was devoted to materialism. I think I was like you. I was an unthinking materialist. I just took it for granted. I just absorbed it from the environment I was in, which was a science environment. When I was a kid, because my mother was religious, I think I was an unthinking dualist. But science and materialism always had control. You know, I sort of admitted religion by the back door and tried to make room for it. But once I went to university at 17, that just fell off. It fell off along the way, and I became an unthinking materialist. I just took it for granted. Things started changing once I started thinking about it. Instead of just taking it for granted, I started thinking about it. I think one of the triggers was when I got to know about a question that David Chalmers, the philosopher of mind, put forward, which is that, you see, it is fundamentally impossible to explain how subjective experience can arise from mass, charge, momentum, or any of the attributes of matter, which are purely quantities attached to abstractions. How can you explain concrete experience out of that? There is a fundamental explanatory gap there. He called it the hard problem of consciousness, which to this day is admitted as a valid problem. It is not something that you can explain. In an anniversary edition of Science Magazine, I think, in 2005, I think it was Science Magazine, I may be wrong, I think it was Science Magazine, they selected, you know, the most important unanswered questions in science. And the hard problem was the second question. The first question was, what's the nature of matter? So, and the second question was, what's the biological basis of consciousness? You know, nobody can explain that today, how an atom can give rise to subjective experience. From the point of view of even evolution by natural selection, consciousness is unnecessary. People like Steve Novella, they try to come up with all kinds of reasons why consciousness would be beneficial, but they fundamentally misunderstand materialism itself. Under materialism, there is no need for consciousness. All structure and function can be explained without subjective experience accompanying it. All the calculations would explain the survival or not of any organism, the biological calculations in their nervous systems, the physical functions of their bodies, that can all be explained without subjective experience accompanying any of that. So consciousness is an unexplained anomaly. And once that became clear to me, yeah, over 10 years ago, I think, that was the trigger. That's what got me thinking. And from then on, the pieces of the puzzle fell in their places rather quickly. You know, the alternative to materialism is not complicated at all. Materialism is contrived, not idealism. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the culture is blasting that contrived alternative to us since we are five-year-old kids going to school. So we absorb that by osmosis, and it becomes very difficult to contemplate an alternative that is actually much simpler. It doesn't suffer from the hard problem of consciousness because we don't need to explain how consciousness emerges from non-consciousness. There is no non-consciousness. Then everything else is simpler. There was only one difficult aspect, which is that we seem to think that we can become unconscious. Like when we are sleeping and not dreaming, like when we are under the effects of anesthesia or certain mental processes that are apparently unconscious, like the way you breathe, apparently unconsciously when you're not thinking of it. And that was the trickiest thing to explain. I ended up, I think it makes a lot of sense, the explanation, but it took me some thinking to get to that. The gist of the answer that I got to is that there is no such a thing as unconsciousness. There are only degrees of consciousness. A particular space of our stream of experiences gets amplified by neural reverberation, which is something that's well known in neuroscience. You know, crosstalk between different brain areas give rise to ordinary awareness. That's pretty much demonstrated. My contention is that it doesn't give rise to consciousness. It amplifies consciousness and thereby obfuscates everything that isn't amplified, like the sun obfuscates the stars at noon. But it doesn't mean that the stars aren't still there in the sky at noon. They are there. Their photons are still hitting your retina. Technically, you're still seeing them, but you don't know that you are seeing them. You don't know that you know them because they are obfuscated. Similarly, in my view, the unconscious are things that you consciously know, but you just don't know that you know. They are obfuscated contents of consciousness. They get obfuscated because of the amplified contents of egoic awareness.
So in one sense, if we are living whirlpools, you could say that the unconscious is, it's on that periphery, it's on that intersection, and we sometimes, again, it bleeds through something like synchronicity or paranormal occurrences or something like that. But again, because we're so much in our own heads, we are able to deny it. Or that's how it
seems.
That's
true. Yeah. Yeah, and memory is very related to that as well. Memory and amnesia is just the traffic of mental contents in and out of the area in which mental contents get amplified by neural reverberation, which is recognized in neuroscience. So when you forget something, it's basically an experience that is still in consciousness, but it drops out of the area of reverberation, of amplification, and therefore gets obfuscated by whatever else gets into that area of reverberation. And that creates the illusion of the unconscious, personal and collective.
And I think another problem materialism runs into with the conscious versus unconscious division is often you hear the argument that consciousness is a quote-unquote emergent phenomenon. So you get enough connections and all of a sudden consciousness appears. Again, like we don't know, like how David Chalmers puts it, we don't know how electrons, their spin, their charge, they add up and atoms add up to all of a sudden this conscious being, unconscious goes to conscious. What is that transition point? And they call it an emergent point where, again, it just appears and you see this with maybe like sand dunes in the desert or something. But then the question becomes, okay, well, there's a lot of connections in the unconscious. How come we're not conscious of the unconscious? Why is there this division? And that can't there's no answer to that in that model.
I would have a few comments to what you said, because you raised lots of very good points. On the idea that consciousness is an emergent property of the brain, I would have two comments. One, this is an appeal to magic. It just labels a mystery. It doesn't explain it. We just give it a name. Oh, it's an emergent phenomenon. But what does it mean? You know, how does it work? We don't know. We just give it a name. And it looks more treatable because we baptized it, because we gave it a name. You see, we explained absolutely nothing, but that's the magic of materialism. It looks more treatable just because we gave it a name. Two, the name is improper. It's an abuse of the concept of emergence to say this. You see, emergence happens when a higher level property arises in a system from the interactions of lower level components of the system. For instance, the fractal patterns in the snowflake, the higher level property, the fractal patterns, arise out of the interactions of water molecules in the process of freezing, the lower level entities in the system. That's actual emergence. Fractal patterns arises from molecule interactions. You refer to sand dunes. Sand dunes with their beautiful patterns emerge out of the interactions of sand grains and wind. This is emergence. David Chalmers would call it weak emergence. In these proper cases of emergence, we can always deduce the higher level property from the properties of the lower level components. In fact, we can put it all in a computer and simulate it and see sand dunes forming your computer screen and see ice crystals forming in your computer screen, because we know the properties of the lower level systems, the lower level components of the system, like water molecules, sand, and wind, and we can deduce the higher level properties from that. That's proper emergence. But in the case of consciousness, we can't do that. We can't do that even in principle. We cannot deduce the redness of red, the bitterness of disappointment, the warmth of love. We cannot deduce that, even in principle, from mass, charge, momentum, any of the attributes of matter. So to say that consciousness is an emergent property of the brain, one is a cop-out. It just names the mystery. It doesn't explain it. And two is an abuse of the word emergence.
All right. So, Bernardo, yeah, we're getting close to an hour. Maybe that's a good place to stop because we've covered a lot of ground. maybe you can give the audience an idea of maybe what you're working on now, where they can find your writings and what they should be on the lookout for.
I'm still promoting my latest book, Why Materialism is Baloney, which is a cheeky title for a very serious work, I believe. You would conclude that from reading it. I've just finished writing a new book called Brief Peaks Beyond, in which I go beyond just metaphysics. I venture into some cultural and social criticism, and I revisit metaphysics in a sharper, more compact, more direct way, less metaphor-loaded, as Why Materialism is Baloney. It's basically a collection of integrated essays. That's basically what I've been doing. And I'm actually working on yet another something, but it's a secret for now. It's for the future, maybe 2 years from now. And it's a long-term goal of mine to explore religion and spirituality from a solid, rational, logical standpoint without denying it. And that's my long-term project, but that's for 2 years down the road. The new book, Brief Peaks Beyond, should be out towards the fall of this year, the end of this year.
All right, so Bernardo, thank you again for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.